House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is Wednesday, May 20th. What we're going to do is kind of go out of order. We have some legislators here that need to testify and get out, so we'll have them. And then I'm going to suspend after that a couple other quick bills, and then we'll get back to the ivory bill, animal parts bill. So Representative Hansel will call a work public hearing on Senate Bill 788. Summarize, please.
As Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 788A is sponsored by Senator Hansel at the request of Dr. Andrew Clark. We have no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact with no statement issued on this bill. It unanimously passed the Senate Judiciary Committee, and it passed the Senate floor with a vote of 27-3 excused. We have no amendments before us today. Currently, the petitioner in a suit for marital annulment, dissolution, or separation is not required to disclose whether any protective orders exist against either party. In certain situations, however, for example, when domestic violence is at issue, such information is crucial for the courts to know. Senate Bill 788A requires the petitioner in a suit for marital annulment, dissolution, or separation to disclose whether there exists in this state or any other jurisdiction a protective order authorized by law between the parties, as well as any order restraining one of the parties from contact with the other party or with the party's minor children. Senate Bill 788A applies to petitions for marital annulment, dissolution, or separation filed on or after the effective date. This bill is ready to move today.
Thank you, Senator.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, for the record, Senator Bill Hansel, State Senator, District 29, Eastern Oregon. Laura did such a great job. I just say, are there any questions? But Senate Bill 788 comes to you from a meeting I had with domestic violence advocates last September. They informed me that currently issues of domestic violence are not required to be brought up to a judge or jury if the family is going through a marriage annulment or a child custody hearing. Although this bill does not look much like a domestic violence bill, I believe the bill will help solve some issues that arise from domestic violence issues. The bill would require that judges be informed of any issues relating to stalking or other restraining orders if the family is going through a marriage annulment or child custody issue. It's a fairly straightforward bill. It does not require the judge to act in a specific way on the information they're given, simply that they're required to know about the prior issues. I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have or try to.
Senator Hansel? Okay, thank you, Senator. We plan to work this day, but we're going to move on right now.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Who else do we have testifying? Okay, then I guess I need to ask it now.
Okay, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So sometimes in my concern, I think probably the only concern I have, is there any way this bill would encourage lawyers to encourage their clients to get protective orders, to color the case in a particular way? And frankly, I think that already exists. Is this going to compound that issue, do you think?
I hope not. Chair Barker, Representative Springer, that is not the intent. It's right now we've got, I believe, a void in the information that judges could use if they were aware of it. And all this does is provide that. It currently isn't there. And the advocates that had come to me with this need said there was a gap there that would be really helpful if the judges were given that information. It doesn't require the judges to act anyway, just that they have this as a part of theirs. I can't guarantee that they're, what actually happens, but that's certainly not the intent.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Chair.
We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 788 and open Senate Bill 913A. Call Senator Hess, Senator Boquist, and Representative Gomberg, please. And if you weren't here when I announced earlier, we're going to have your testimony, then suspend the hearing and take care of a couple other items of business. And then
we're always being suspended.
Senator.
I'll begin under suspension then.
Okay.
That's okay. Mr. Chair and members of the House Judiciary Committee, this is an unusual bill for the Oregon Legislature because it seeks to fix a problem on the other side of the planet in Africa, trying to save these elephants from being killed because of the ivory and the value. And it turns out that states can have an effect on slowing that down. Senate Bill 913 would ban the sale of ivory in Oregon. As you know, it's a state, our state, with a strong conservation spirit, a love for wildlife. And I've passed out testimony here. I won't read through that for you, because it's, even though I know how much you enjoy it when people do that. But really, this bill...
Senator, you need to say your name.
Mark Hass, Oregon State Senate. Sorry.
I recognized him right off.
Yeah, you, I said, that's right.
6 o'clock.
You look familiar, but I wasn't sure.
Okay. Well, this is going to go down as one of the weakest testimonies before a committee I've ever been responsible for. But it has, I think, a lot of sideboards in here. If you possess ivory, for example, this law won't affect you. If you give those items away, give them to a relative or accept them from your grandmother, this law won't affect you. The ivory police will not come to your house. To me, there's another reason for having a state law banning the sale of ivory, and that is it continues to raise awareness that there is still a great deal of poaching going on, and it's serving markets. Number one is China, but number two is the United States, even though it is, for all intents and purposes, illegal here. And so I think for raising the awareness that these great beasts are in danger and that this continues every single day, is that by itself is reason enough to pass this bill. So I urge your thoughtful consideration for it, and thank you for taking it up.
Next.
You're next.
All right.
You have substance.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. David Gomberg from House District 10 on the Central Oregon coast. And I came to you today to talk about the fact that this is not just a feel-good bill. This is not just an esoteric issue. I wanted to talk about the fact that it's real. And it's going on here. There is a massive international market for ivory that's got a detrimental economic, social, and environmental effect. In an effort to combat the problem, President Obama issued an executive order committing the United States to do its part in combating the illicit ivory trade. But as you'll hear in testimony later on today, these federal regulations are difficult, if not impossible, to enforce. And for that reason, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is encouraging states like Oregon to enact state bans. Now, I think it would probably be easy to say that that Oregon is a small player in a much bigger picture, and that maybe there isn't a whole lot that we can do here that's going to have a meaningful difference. But I would say that if we're a small state, we can have a big impact for a couple of reasons. First of all, we could be the first state outside of New York and New Jersey to enact one of these bans. I'm one of those people that likes to see Oregon doing good things and leading the way rather than following other trends. The second thing is that we've got a major port here and a major airport, which is a relevant part of this trafficking problem. And the third thing, as I alluded to when I first started, is that the problem is real. And I wanted to give you a couple of quick examples. Just 2 weeks ago, an Iowa taxidermist pleaded guilty to trafficking rhino horns that came from Oregon, about $16,000 worth. Now, the transaction was coordinated by two California businessmen who then sent the horns into black markets in Vietnam and Southeast Asia, Iowa, California, Vietnam, China, and Oregon. The second thing is that my staff tried to get some information this week out of Port of Portland and PDX on confiscations and arrests that took place on the ivory issue there. And we were not able to come back with specifics. They were unable to release that information to us. But we were assured that there is a continuing problem at the Port of Portland. And the last example I wanted to share with you, I really found quite interesting. The International Fund for Animal Welfare has released a study that they did last month that examined ivory sales on Craigslist. And what they did is they wanted to examine the prevalence of the ivory trade in the U.S., so they looked for posts containing ivory, suspected ivory, and wildlife products. And in 4 days, and in 28 cities, investigators found 615 items with a dollar value of $1,429,151. 4 days, 615 items, about $1.5 million in dollar values. What was startling to me is that one of the areas that they investigated was Corvallis and Albany, and that they found in just 4 days there were 25 items in 18 posts worth about $20,000 coming out of the Corvallis and Albany area, which they deemed as significant compared to most of the other cities that they investigated. Corvallis and Albany had a higher dollar value of products than Dallas and the state of Hawaii, and more total items than New York or Hawaii or San Diego or Atlanta or Las Vegas. So this is real here. By the way, since this study was done, Craigslist has discontinued its participation in ivory trade by prohibiting sales on their webpage. But this is just part of the growing consensus that selling ivory is unacceptable. I'd say that banning the sale of ivory in Oregon will provide additional and more stringent regulation of the ivory trade and is consistent with federal law. Given the impacts on this particular kind of trade, curbing the ivory market here in Oregon, I think, is an imperative, and we've got a great opportunity to do something.
Thank you. Well, that was a strange cutoff. I thought so, too. That's where it ended.
You did. I'm Brian Boquist, State Senator, District 12. I'm not here as the state senator, though. I have been on every one of the odd couples bills here since 2005. I think it started with monkeys, and then we had snakes. I think we even had iguanas. We had virtually every tropical creature known to man, all those creepy crawlies from Africa, Asia, Latin America, and everything else. And I've been on all of those bills, and I've not been on them to save the elephant or the monkey or any of that, and I'm going to come back to that topic. The second point I'd like to put in the testimony, more for the benefit of not you folks, because we're all pretty safe about this, is that I did look at the testimony and some of the stuff that was submitted by people who are passionate on this on both sides of the issue. I would point out that under federal law today, virtually everything plus more that is in the draft SB 913 you have in front of you is in fact federal law. And I'm more attuned than anyone else, especially with too many kids in the military where they put stuff on their Facebook and then they get prosecuted for it. You probably want to be careful what you say, because some of the things in the previous testimony people said is already a violation of the federal law. And if you transfer pieces of ivory and some of this other stuff, you're required under federal law through the U.S. Department of Fish and Wildlife to get a standard permit and certificate, whether it be a gun or anything like that. And I'm not going to touch the gun piece because I'm perfectly happy either way you move with this. So let me go on why the odd couple is sitting here before you, since I'm not overly concerned about the elephant. It is a little tough to eat for those who haven't eaten it. It's a little rubbery, too. Having said that, there was a mistake made on the floor of the Senate that I want to convey to you through a unintentional slip of the tongue or not people paying attention. I don't know what happens on your floor, but we're not all riveted during these testimonies. And so, you know, somebody heard a comment, somebody said this, and the next thing you know, the floor of the Senate erupted into this battle over terrorism. And, you know, it's kind of odd when you're the lone person out of the 30 that has any experience on the ground in this particular field. And you're thinking like, okay, did they just come from the Measure 91 committee? Did they smoke in something? Because they have no clue what they're talking about here. Now, that is exactly why I've been on every one of these bills before. Not because I want to save the monkey, not because of that. I have personally experienced firsthand over the last 38 years now, had personal experience firsthand with dealing with smuggling, financing of rebel organizations, 7 or 8 coups in strange places, some of you that don't even exist because the names have been changed, so on and so forth. And one of the unfortunate consistent patterns out of that is the people that I was over there with got shot and killed by arms and ammunition from the United States of America, bought and paid for by smuggled creatures. Now, I'm not going to blame the federal government, but I will just blatantly say they get to pick and choose, as you well know. Gee, one day we were aligned with Saddam Hussein as our friend, and the next day we're against him. This sort of thing happens all the time. I could track at one point in a situation with some good friends of mine who are now buried in sandboxes where stuff coming in and out of Texas was being financed by this trade, and the American government looked the other way because we happened to be political allies with those people back and forth. back in 2005, that's how I got on the first bill. I didn't get on there to save, I don't think it was the monkeys. We were saving something else back then. But that's why I got on the bill. So my warning to you is contrary to popular belief, this smuggling does finance it. I did send some of you, or I sent the committee, and there's some articles posted. You can believe them or not believe them. What I would just tell you, though, is that this sort of trade that is right here, if the federal government was doing its job, I think both speakers virtually said this, we wouldn't be having this discussion. But they don't do their job. And so this stuff trades back and forth. It creates a cash market. They then buy stuff and they export it from the United States and elsewhere. And then, unfortunately, people like me get to go over there. I'm retired now, by the way. Get to go over there and deal with this. And frankly, I'm fine with that. But there's a lot of those people that didn't come back. And that's why I've been on every one of these bills from beginning to end. I get the argument, you're going to hear it later, that this shouldn't be a gun bill. I'm fine with that. I don't care one way or the other. My point is that from my personal perspective, not as a state senator, is that this is just another tool that we can utilize to prevent people like me having to call wives.
Any questions? Great. Thank you, panel.
Thank you, committee.
I'm going to suspend the hearing on Senate Bill 913. Okay, open a work session on Senate Bill 740.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, you heard Senate Bill 740 a few weeks ago. This is a bill about removing the requirement that arresting officer pay for an interpreter for a person who is hearing disabled or speaking disabled. This brings Oregon law into alignment with the federal law. Now, Rep. Greenlick, you had some questions about this bill. So we went and called legislative counsel, and we had a lengthy discussion on the interpretation of this bill. And Jessica Manifi did some excellent research on this, and it turns out that when this bill was created, there were amendments adopted verbally in committee that may or may not have reflected the intention of the committee at the time they adopted the amendments. So even the origin of this bill is a little cloudy. Right now, in statute, it says that that potentially non-English speaking people are required to have an interpreter under this statute. Once the person is arraigned and booked, a different statute takes effect. It's divided in two between those who are hearing impaired and those who have a language impairment. There are case law that shows that maybe in some places courts are using this to require interpreters for non-English speakers, and there's some evidence that courts don't use this. So because of that, we'd like to do some research on this in the interim and come up with a really good proposal to clarify what the policy should be. This bill is ready to move today.
Okay, any questions?
Thank you.
Moody.
740.
All right. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 740 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 740 to the floor with due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion, Representative Barton?
So just to clarify where we're at, I gather we are moving this bill today to bring Oregon into compliance with federal law. Seems a prudent step, but then we're going to discuss in the interim to maybe even go further. Is that?
Yes, good. Brett Barton, correct.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? Are there any objections? 740 passes. Would anybody like to carry the bill? Representative Williamson, please. Open a work session on Senate Bill 908A.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, Senate Bill 908A comes from the Senate Judiciary Committee. We had a public hearing on this bill yesterday. This is the bill that modifies Oregon's expungement statute. It was a product of a work group between the DAs and OCDLA. We have the dash A2 amendment before the committee, which simply deletes the word traffic violation and inserts motor vehicle violation. There's no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact. It's ready to move with the A2s.
I thought it went from motor vehicle to traffic.
It goes from traffic to motor vehicle.
Mm-hmm. Any discussion? Okay.
Chair, I move the dash A2 amendments into Senate Bill 908A.
Representative Williamson moves the dash 2 amendments into Senate Bill 908A. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, the amendments are in.
Chair, I move Senate Bill 908A as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves Senate Bill 908A as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Representative Springer, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today on this bill in committee, I'm going to be voting no. I may be changing that on the floor, but at this point, I'm just to let you know I'm going to be no.
Okay. Any further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Greenwood?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Weininger?
Aye.
Post?
Aye.
Representative Springer?
No.
Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Williamson?
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Olson will be the carrier. And we'll do one more work session on open a work session on Senate Bill 175.
Yes, Chair Barker, members of the committee. Senate Bill 175 comes to us at the request of the Audubon Society of Portland. We have no revenue impact and minimal fiscal impact on this bill. It passed the Senate Judiciary and the Senate floor with one nay vote in each. We previously had a public hearing on this bill on May 7th. We have no amendments before us today either. So the 76th Legislative Assembly passed Senate Bill 924 during the 2011 regular session. Senate Bill 924 mandated that offenders receive certain minimal penalties when they are convicted of certain wildlife crimes. That bill, however, contained a sunset clause which took effect in January of this year. Senate Bill 175 reinstitutes Senate Bill 924 without a sunset clause. The bill is ready to move.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 175 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 175 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? I would only say that Representative Krieger is going to be working during the interim to look into some amendments, or what we had earlier as amendments, look into try to make the bill a better, make the law a better law. But we'll do that in the 16th. We expect to bring that back in the 16th session. Are there any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. Representative Krieger, would you carry that for us, please? Thank you. Okay, now we'll go back to. And we'll go back to Senate Bill 788 and open a work session on Senate Bill 788.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 788 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams moves Senate Bill 788 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Representative Weininger, would you like to carry
that? Sure.
Okay,
thank you.
Okay, we'll go back to the and we did on the one, we did have Representative Springer down, so no, on the vote. Okay. Thank you.
We just made these things.
Reopen the Senate Bill 913 and call Iris Ho, Natasha Dozal, and Shervin Hess, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Iris Ho, and I'm here today representing the Humane Society of the United States, the nation's largest animal protection organization, and our global affiliate, Humane Society International. I'm here in strong support of Senate Bill 913A. You have before you today an important legislative tool that has been applauded by advocates here in Oregon, nationwide, and also far away in Kenya and in China. Senate Bill 913A is Oregon's contribution to stopping the ivory trade and the market demand that is fueling the elephant poaching crisis in Africa. And I'd like to outline a few exemptions that's in the legislation, including certain exemptions for guns and firearms and musical instruments. And there's also a 15-month delay implementation date. And so this is a very sensible legislative tool that will have minimal economic impact on the Oregon businesses and individuals. And I'll be happy to answer questions after my testimony. Opponents of Senate Bill 913A cited outer statements from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and they argue that the United States does not contribute to the illegal ivory trade. However, since July 2013, when President Obama issued an executive order on combating wildlife trafficking, the service has made numerous statements identifying the U.S. role in the illegal ivory trade. Specifically, the service director, Dan Ash, has remarked the U.S. market is contributing to the crisis now threatening the African elephant. The largely unregulated domestic trade in elephant ivory has served as a loophole that gives cover for illegal trade. Furthermore, the service last year warned that a substantial amount of elephant ivory is illegally imported and enters the domestic market. And several research reports have backed up those statements. A survey in 2008 in the U.S. found that an estimated one-third of ivory for sale is illegal here in the U.S. In a report released just a few months ago by the Natural Resources Defense Council, found that in California, which is a neighbor state of Oregon, up to 90% of ivory in Los Angeles and up to 80% of ivory in San Francisco for sale was astonishingly illegal. And let's be real, no one is going to admit that the ivory they sell or own is illegal, even though most people have no documentations to prove the provenance or the legality of the item. Just because an ivory item is sold in an antique store here in our border or gift shop doesn't mean that it was imported legally in the first place. And it is undisputed that legal markets, whether it's here in the U.S., in Europe, or in China, have become a cover for illegal ivory due to insufficient inspection, enforcement, convoluted ivory trade schemes, and challenges to distinguish illegal ivory from legally acquired ivory. And as you can see before you, a few items here that were seized by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which my fellow panelist, Natasha, will address later. These items, you know, look exactly like many legally acquired ivory that you can see in stores here in Oregon and in other places across the U.S. An opponent of Senate Bill 913A said that banning ivory sales would not sell one single elephant. Ironically, it is the same argument and resistance that I hear again and again from the Chinese government officials during my conversations with them. And mind you, that China has an ivory registration system, possibly the only one in the world. And this system mandates that every piece of ivory item for sale in retail market in China comes with a photo of the item and the government registration card. And in Hong Kong, every ivory retail store is mandated to display a government certificate permitting them to sell ivory. Here in the U.S., once the item made it into the market, whether it's illegally or legally, there are essentially no mechanism to track or monitor the movement of the ivory item. And the United States does not register or license importers, manufacturers, wholesalers, and retailers dealing in raw, semi-worked, or worked ivory items. And also, we do not have a compulsory trade controls over raw ivory, and we do not have a comprehensive and demonstrably effective reporting and enforcement system for sales of work ivory. So it's interesting that the Chinese government, the pro-ivory traders, is using a similar argument as the opponents of this bill. And they say that the ivory they sell come from a legal source and that stopping sales of ivory of dead elephants won't save one single elephant. And the opponents also said that they can distinguish various types of ivory. What they conveniently fail to point out is that it is visually difficult to distinguish elephant ivory from mammoth ivory without specialized training. unsuspecting consumers would not know what Schrager line is, test is. This is a test, a method to distinguish mammoth ivory from elephant ivory. And mammoth ivory and elephant ivory have been found commingled in shipping and also in retail display. And in addition, it is impossible to distinguish Asian elephant ivory from African elephant ivory without DNA analysis. This is important because federal law and regulations treat these two types of ivory differently. And furthermore, it is visually challenging or almost impossible to distinguish old ivory from ivory of recently poached elephants without carbon dating or other scientific analysis. And even then, it is not always possible to tell the difference between ivories of these closely related species. And that is why the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service Ivory Identification Guide specifically reminded readers that while the methods described in this handbook are reliable for the purpose described, an examination of the carved ivory object by a trained scientist is still necessary to obtain a positive identification of the species source. And opponents of the bill said that China, the largest destination for illegal ivory, would not listen to what we do here. Several examples prove that China is taking cues from what is happening here in the U.S., and that diplomatic and NGO engagement on this particular issue has yielded some positive results. Take shark fin, for example. The Hong Kong and Chinese governments have prohibited serving of shark fins at all levels of official functions. Advocates in China were encouraged and motivated by the momentum swept across here in the U.S., including here in Oregon, to prohibit the sale of shark fins. And soon after, the United States crushed 6 tons of confiscated ivory to demonstrate the U.S. commitment to combat ivory trafficking. China and Hong Kong follow suit. So how can we ask other countries to give up shark fins, which this legislature passed the law 2 years ago, or to shut down ivory markets when we ourselves are not leading by example? Oregon alone cannot solve the poaching crisis, and Oregon is not alone in closing the ivory market. This bill is part of a growing momentum together with other states and the federal government to shut down the ivory trade. It is a sensible solution to a global crisis. And some of you might have read the editorial from Statesman Journal today, you know, and the title is What Happens in Africa Does Not Stay Here. And I would like to say it works the other way, too. What happens in Oregon does not just stay here. Senate Bill 913A gives Oregon a unique opportunity to make history and become the first state on the Pacific coast to prohibit the sale of ivory and rhino horns. Thank you.
Go ahead and do them.
Okay.
I have questions when you're back.
Okay. Chair Barker and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify today. My name is Natasha Dolezal. I live in Southwest Portland. I'm a former prosecutor, and now I'm the director at the Center for Animal Law Studies at Lewis and Clark of the LLM program and the Kenya Legal Project. I'm here today on behalf of myself in support of 913A. I've submitted detailed written testimony, but I want to summarize a few of the main points. My work takes me to Kenya, and in that capacity, I work with prosecutors and legislators and judges and wildlife officials and ask them what we can do to help them there. And so they're on the ground, and they're trying to save the elephants every day and prosecute those who have been caught poaching. And they've enacted a stricter Wildlife Management Act, which convicted poachers face now life in prison. But what they still ask us today to do is to shut down the market. And I'm here today to ask you all to support that. And why it's important in Oregon, I want to point out to you some testimony that I submitted on behalf of Oregon State University, Dr. Bill Ripple. He recently published an article in Science Magazine, the online version of Science. He led a team of international scientists in Africa to study large herbivores. And what he found is that the loss of the elephants and rhinos is due to poaching. And this loss will have devastating ecological consequences that will spread from Africa to the rest of the world. And one of the reasons that Oregon is so important is what was mentioned. The U.S. is one of the largest markets, and Oregon is part of the U.S. The ivory that was passed around today was loaned to me by Fish and Wildlife Service, the regional office in Wilsonville. And when I was speaking with them, I learned that they receive one call a week at least about ivory. And they have three agents. And they're responsible not just for Oregon, but the Pacific region, which includes Washington, Idaho, Oregon, Hawaii, and American Samoa. And they get at least one call a week about what to do with their ivory. And so, you know, we looked up some Craigslist ads, eBay, Oregon auction houses. And what you can find there easily is that ivory items are listed as ivory sometimes, and it says they're pre-ban ivory, or they're listed as bone. And there's ways that people are working to get around that when they know they don't have the documentation. And that's something I want to reiterate that Senator Boquist mentioned. Right now, if you're an artist in Oregon and you crafted a knife, or you have a gun with an ivory handle, or you have mom's silverware and you try to sell it, you still need, under federal guidelines, you still need documentation that that ivory is African or Asian, different rules apply, and that it was imported properly. And so what we're doing isn't any different than what the feds are doing right now. If you have ivory and you try to sell it in Oregon or interstate, between states, and it's no different. And what the problem is, there's three agents who are supposed to enforce this. They can't look up and follow up on every Craigslist ad. And the different laws that apply to the ivory, the Asian or the African, you can't tell the difference visually. And you also probably wonder why maybe mammoth is also listed in the bill. Mammoth is a cover item for importing it. You can find ivory mixed amongst mammoth ivory. And also, when you're trying to sell it, people say it's mammoth. And you really can't tell visually. You might hear testimony that says there's Schrager lines, these cross hatchings that are in the ivory that you can look at and you can easily tell that it's ivory or ivory versus mammoth. It's not so easy. You actually have to take a photocopy of the cross hatchings. You have to measure each one. You have to then take a protractor and find the angle of those measurements from a significant number of cross hatchings in order to obtain an average. Then and only then, if you determine whether the majority of the degree is over 100 degrees versus less than 100 degrees, can you tell if it's mammoth or elephant. And then the other question is, how old is the ivory? There's no test to determine that effectively. Even if you do carbon dating, that can't get specific enough to tell you if it was imported December 1989 versus January 1990. That's not helpful. So I hope that you can see that there's a challenge here in enforcement, not only in the lack of officers who are able to enforce the federal law, but in the current federal scheme. These laws were not designed to meet the current crisis. They worked for a while, but once organized crime and terrorists started getting involved, they're not effective. They're not protecting the elephant or the rhino. And so what is clear is that states do need to enact a ban because this current system does not offer any protection. And you might hear testimony from people who own musical instruments or guns and what they can do if they want to sell it and how. And under the federal guidelines, guns have serial numbers, and the serial numbers usually date to a manufacturer where you can substantiate a date, and that date is good enough. And the same with musical instruments. And so people with silverware or trinkets or inherited items, you can still keep those items. But under the current federal law, you can't sell those either unless your grandmother gave you a way to document that that item was here legally. And in closing, I just want to say that it's unjustifiable for Oregon to support and allow the commercialization of elephants and rhinos at a time when people around the world are risking their lives daily and dying in order to protect them. And this is the world's natural heritage, not just in Kenya, not just in South Africa. And these rangers are forced to become soldiers. And I want to close with a quote from a fellow colleague and friend in Zimbabwe. His name is Bryce Clements. He says, "I'm a game ranger who is on the front lines of the war against poaching in Africa. I am responsible for the protection of a 740,000-acre park that is home to the Big Five and many endangered species. I have 30 game rangers under my supervision. As wildlife custodians, we are daily putting our lives on the line against armed poachers in the defense of wildlife. The rate of poaching in Africa, particularly of rhino and elephant, is not sustainable. As rangers, it doesn't make sense to put our lives on the line every day to protect the same wildlife that people are legally trading in their body parts. We need the laws everywhere to reflect the intrinsic value of these creatures, or our risk and work is futile. Thank you.
Thank you.
Right. Chair Barker and members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to testify on behalf of Metro and the Oregon Zoo in support of Senate Bill 913. My name is Shervin Hess, and I oversee conservation advocacy for the zoo. We're at a historic moment right now in terms of the survival of elephants and the global effort to save them. In the past 20 years, two-thirds of the world's African elephants have been killed for their tusks. At this current rate, they could completely vanish within the next two decades. In February, the White House launched a plan for combating the illegal wildlife trade, and they focus heavily on reducing the demand for illegally traded wildlife. Just 2 weeks ago, the United Arab Emirates destroyed their 11-ton stockpile of confiscated ivory, and they followed in the footsteps of the United States, China, and nations across Europe, Asia, and Africa. These efforts are all aimed at shutting down a terrorism-funding industry that will drive one of our most iconic species to extinction. A federal ban now prohibits nearly all import, export, and interstate trade in ivory, but that law leaves ivory sales within the states uncontrolled, enabling a black market for newly poached ivory. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service states that it is extremely difficult to differentiate between legally acquired ivory and that which is newly poached, which you've heard a number of times today. Their investigations and their anti-smuggling efforts also reveal that legal ivory trade can serve as a cover for the illegal trade. New York and New Jersey, as you've also heard, have already addressed this issue by banning sales within their states, and it's time for Oregon to do its part by ensuring that our state does not provide a safe haven for terrorists and poachers to launder ivory. Oregon has a special connection with elephants that spans half a century, dating back to the birth of Packy at the Oregon Zoo. And for several decades, we have supported on-the-ground conservation efforts across all elephant range countries. In 2013, we joined the Wildlife Conservation Society's 96 Elephant Campaign to eliminate the trade that kills elephants for their tusks. Our goal is to create a better future for wildlife at the zoo, and this legislation will give us a tool to do that. It's worth reiterating that this bill does not prohibit the possession or ownership or gifting of ivory, only sales, and the exemptions which cover certain guns, knives, and musical instruments were crafted to address those that would be most economically impacted. So in closing, thank you for your consideration of these comments and for your support of Senate Bill 913, which will help to close this black market loophole. Let's make sure that future generations don't look back and say we allowed elephants to go extinct because we wanted to sell ivory. Elephants need ivory. Humans do not. Thank you.
Thank you. So I have a question. So I talked to a gun dealer who deals in used guns, and he said he did have some guns with ivory handles. So is there a certain date of the manufacture of those guns that would exempt them from this? Or
well, there's a by volume, 20% by volume, and And then the gun,
right, and they, if the gun is manufactured prior to 1976.
76, okay.
And we understand that, you know, most, you know, a lot of guns, that's what we're hearing, they are using old ivory, and that's why we believe that, you know, this should cover most guns.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Representative Krieger.
You mentioned that most imports were banned. What is not banned?
I know that it's not an absolute. As I've read the language, In the federal legislation, it is not absolute.
The banned import ban has loopholes. For example, if it's an Asian elephant ivory, if it's an antique, by definition, federal definition, it's at least 100 years old, then it can't be imported. But it would need to have documentation. But what we learned is that a lot of the documents are fraudulent. It's easy to falsify them. And so that's for Asian elephant ivory. And for African elephant ivory, because the bans came into effect in 1990, so anything, if it's, you know, ivory that's before 1990, then they could be imported with the, you know, with the banned certificate. And so as you can see, you know, it's very confusing, and you have to be able to determine the species, whether it's Asian elephant ivory or African elephant ivory, because they are governed separately and differently under federal law.
Follow up, please. There are limited legal hunts for elephants in Africa, where you have to pay a fee and a tag. And that ivory that was legally taken, is not there a federal process for importing that legally into the United States now? In other words, there's a form with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Representative Krieger, I think what you're asking is, if you go to Africa in places where they allow sport hunting, when you have the proper permit and you wish to bring back your elephant trophy, that is still allowed under federal law.
Okay. Further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Crackle, Renee Tranto, Brian Posewitz, and George, I don't see George Coolidge. So. You go in any order, but remember to identify yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Go ahead and start. Chair Barker, committee members, my name is David Cracky. I'm with an organization called Wild Aid. I sit on their international board here in strong support of Senate Bill 913A. Wild Aid's focus is on demand, as I've mentioned in prior testimony, and demand drives everything with regard to poaching of elephants and rhinos. Our only defense against demand, or at least our best defense against demand, is a ban on the sale of those items. If we allow the sale of ivory and rhino horns, we fuel demand. We end up supporting two outcomes that we've heard about in previous testimony. The first outcome is extinction. The second outcome is terrorism. If we ban the sale of ivory and rhino horns, we end up supporting the continued existence of elephants and rhinos, and we support efforts to prevent terrorism. This is an important vote on these two issues, extinction and terrorism. We're either against extinction or not. We're either against terrorism or not. Extinction is a fundamental issue in my mind. I have a deep faith that follows. It says that we are stewards, and I believe that it's our obligation to ensure the survival of species such as elephants and rhinos, especially these species that are under such extreme pressure right now, and they do deserve our help. With regard to the terrorism issue, Senator Boquist identified and eloquently described the consequences. Wild Aid is well aware of that link as well. In fact, one of our great supporters at Wild Aid, Catherine Bigelow, just created a short film called The Last Days of Ivory. Catherine Bigelow is well known for her Academy Award for The Hurt Locker, director of The Hurt Locker, as well as for Zero Dark Thirty. In Last Days, which I would urge everyone to take a look at, it's about 3.5 minutes long,
Catherine Bigelow describes the Westgate Mall attack in Nairobi. She kind of works backwards in that short film from the person buying the trinket of ivory. In the film, it's depicted in Asia. It might as well be in Portland. Regardless, it shows that this ivory sale helps fund the Westgate Mall, funded the Westgate Mall terrorism attack that happened back in September of 2013, left 67 dead, 175 wounded. A terrorist group called Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility, and in digging into the group, it was determined that Al-Shabaab alone obtains approximately $600,000 per month in ivory profits alone. It's also known that terrorist groups Boko Haram, the Lord's Resistance Army, and the Janjaweed militia also profit from the illegal trade in ivory and in rhino horn. These groups use all the dollars from poaching to fund their terrorism. Every 15 minutes, an elephant is killed. 96 are killed every day. And it's estimated, although we just heard that it might be up to 20 years, WildAid estimates that it could be 11 years before elephants are extinct in the wild. What we do in Oregon does matter. You might say that it's not here, and it is. Representative Gohmert explained this. He talked about the issue that was just in the newspapers about the Iowa taxidermist pleading guilty to trafficking rhino horns from Oregon. They were black rhino horns. They were transported from Oregon to Iowa. This was a federal violation, a Lacey Act violation, and unfortunately no state law currently addresses this issue. I dug a little bit further into this. I read the plea agreement that's available online in this matter. The defendant stated that he knew it was illegal to do what he was doing. He knew that the rhino horns would have gone toward the making of libation cups of traditional medicines. The buyers were paying $5,000 to $7,000 per pound. The fair market value of the seized items in China and Vietnam were valued at a minimum of $1 million to $2.5 million. This gentleman in Iowa pled to a penalty that required him to pay back $500,000. There was a seizure of trucks, trailers, equipment. There were other assessments. There's additional supervision. There is the federal law, but there is no state law. This is a giant loophole. And in other words, if all the transactions had occurred in Oregon, then there would be no crime until such time as they were hopefully caught trying to fly out of the state of Oregon. We have an opportunity to close this loophole, and I urge you all to do so. Rhino horn and ivory from Oregon drives demand in China, in Vietnam, in the United States. Demand drives extinction. Demand drives terrorism. Our best weapon, no pun intended, against the demand is a ban. We should use that weapon. And again, we are either for elephant and rhino survival or we're not. We're either against terrorism or we're not. And this is a very important vote. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, members of the committee. My name is Brian Posowitz. I'm here on behalf of a new organization called Humane Oregon. Humane Oregon was formed last year to help promote animal welfare through participation in Oregon's political process and elections. My testimony today is going to be mercifully short because I don't have a lot to add to that excellent testimony that's already been given. Humane Oregon supports Senate Bill 913. As you've heard, elephants and rhinos are being driven to extinction by poaching to satisfy markets for ivory and rhino horn products, including markets in the United States. Federal law limits this to some extent, but the federal laws are complicated, easily exploited, and difficult to enforce. State laws are needed to help complement the federal law and to close gaps in the federal regulatory and enforcement scheme. Oregon should join other states in doing this. The exemptions in Senate Bill 913 should not be expanded beyond the exemptions in the A. Engrossed version. One of the biggest problems with regulation of illegal ivory is that exceptions in the laws tend to swallow the rule by making enforcement too difficult. Oregon should therefore pass an effective ban with few, if any, exceptions. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Please.
Thank you, Chairman Barker. My name is Renee Tatro, and I've never testified in a hearing before, so here I am. I'm here as an Oregon voter, but I'm also here as a hunter. I'm a gun owner. I am a member of the NRA. I am also on the National Council for the Humane Society of the United States. So I'm not sure what box I fit in, but mostly I'm here as a concerned passenger on this planet. I know you're going to be hearing from the NRA today, and the NRA, like the Republican Party and the Democratic Party and the Independent Party, is made up of individual members, rank-and-file members. It doesn't always speak with one voice, and I expect you'll hear something different from the official NRA spokesman today. But as a member of the rank-and-file of the NRA, who, in fact, owns a lot of guns, I mean, I would say that none of the guns that I own, none of the guns I got from my dad when he passed away, have any ivory in them. And I think that the vast majority of the NRA, rank-and-file NRA members here in Oregon, don't have an issue with the ivory in their guns. It's not there. And then if you go to the next step, an even smaller percentage, and I would expect it to be a vanishingly small percentage, of rank-and-file members of the NRA in Oregon who have weapons with more than 20% of their volume or weight made up of ivory. I think that's just a vanishingly small number. And then you carve that even smaller when you ask how many of those want to sell those weapons, because those are things that are passed down from generation to generation. They're not sold. So when we're talking about the impact that this has on the rank and file members of the NRA, my expectation is that it's very small. Now, I've sat and listened to all the testimony that's been given today and been very impressed by it. I've never seen either of these magnificent creatures in the wild. I have a dream that someday I'll do that. But I think that all of us in this room would be hard-pressed to think of two creatures that are more magnificent and more worthy of being saved. And while I've never seen these creatures in the wild, I'm here today because I have a 6-year-old grandson, and you know, I listen to these numbers, and I've done this research myself, so I know it's true. I don't want my 6-year-old grandson in 20 years to want to see these creatures in the wild and say, well, you know, the reason I can't is because my grandfather was too darn busy that day to go down and talk to the Oregon legislature to tell them what he thought and ask them to do their part. That's why I'm here today, because I want to help everybody on this planet, not just Oregonians, preserve the right to see these animals. I want to leave you with a couple of numbers to contemplate, because I think they speak such volumes about the role that we all have to play here. On our planet, our little small planet, there are about 5,000 mammalian species that exist today. Now, that sounds like kind of a lot when you just say, well, it's a big number. But you could put 20 times that number into Autzen Stadium. So we're dealing with a fairly finite set of mammals. The scientists who study these things, and I'm not one of them, but I try and read a lot about what's going on our planet, tell us that about 0.1% of species on our planet go extinct every year. That's this year, 5. Next year, 5. The next year after that, 5 more. And that is at a rate which far exceeds that which takes place by natural processes. So let's not, and I urge you as strongly as I can, let's not add elephants and rhinos to that list of extinct species. Let's do our part, and let's not have any of you have to say or have your grandchildren say about you that you had an opportunity in 2015 to do your part to try and stop the extinction of these magnificent creatures, and you didn't do it. Thank you for your time and attention.
Any questions for this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. I appreciate it. Four more people signed up. Doug Ritter, Alvin Richards, I will call up everybody. Kevin Sterrett and Roger Beyer, please. Again, you can go in any order. Just remember to identify yourself for the record, please.
Chairman Barker, members of the committee, my name is Doug Ritter. I'm here representing Knife Rights. Knife Rights represents America's and Oregon's millions of knife owners and collectors, knife makers, scrimshaw artists, knife retailers, and suppliers to knife makers and scrimshaw artists, many of whom own legally acquired knives or knives with ivory components or raw ivory. And as it turns out, like many Americans, many of our members also own a wide range of items that include ivory. Knife Rights has submitted detailed written testimony opposing SB 913. I apologize for the length of this written testimony, but you have heard a great deal of misinformation and outright lies today, and we attempt to factually respond to each of these in our written testimony and our ivory ban white paper. I will briefly summarize the problems we have with this bill. First off, Knife Rights and all we represent abhor the poaching of all animals, and we unequivocally support science-based conservation efforts that have proven successful in posting significant gains in elephant populations in Africa over the past few decades. As was pointed out, I am going to tell you that SB 913 will not save a single living elephant. But it is disingenuous to suggest that because China, who won't even admit that they are the world leader in the illegal ivory trade, uses the same phrase, means it doesn't mean anything. It's simply a fact. But it will have negative financial impact on many of your law-abiding constituents who own or work with ivory. Knife Rights unequivocally supports practical and lawful efforts to defend elephants in the field from poachers, as well as lawful enforcement activities that directly target the illegal black market trade in ivory. These policies have resulted in an internationally recognized reduction in elephant poaching over the past 3 years. SB 913 accomplished none of these effective and proven objectives. It is an emotionally driven, feel-good, do-bad legislation at its worst. Again, SB 913 will not save a single living elephant, but it will hurt thousands of Oregonians. SB 913 flies in the face of study after study and federal government statements made prior to the politically motivated change in policy at Fish and Wildlife Service that there is virtually no illegal ivory market in the United States, and that the legal trade in decades-old legal ivory in the U.S. has no influence whatsoever on the poaching of elephants in Africa. The concept of an illegal ivory market in the U.S. flies in the face of common sense. The black market price of raw ivory in China exceeds $1,500 a pound. The price for perfectly legal and readily available decades-old ivory in the U.S. is about $250 a pound. What criminal is going to run the risk of smuggling illegal ivory into the U.S. with its internationally effective, recognized effective customs enforcement when they can sell poached ivory in China for six times the U.S. price? SB 913 even bans 10,000-year-old mammoth ivory. I'm sorry to inform the committee and this bill's supporters, but we cannot save the mammoths. They're gone. And it is, indeed, easily possible to recognize the difference between mammoth ivory and elephant ivory. To suggest that we cannot tell the difference is akin to saying, let's arrest everyone in this room because you all look like you could be criminals. This misguided ivory ban is ill-conceived, offensive, and an unconstitutional taking of private property. As you heard, ivory bans passed two states last year, New York and New Jersey, What they didn't tell you is that these bills passed after the normal legislative process was short-circuited and circumvented to pass these bills. What they didn't tell you is that not a single ivory ban bill has passed this year to date. They have been defeated in Arkansas, Florida, Hawaii, Iowa, Illinois, Maryland, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, and Washington. They have been defeated because once the facts are known to legislators, legislators understand how terrible this bill is for your constituents. What they didn't tell you is that a year and a half after Fish and Wildlife announced that they would issue a final rule shortly on the federal ivory ban, they still have not done so because it is so terribly problematic to do so. What they didn't tell you is that there is a bill in Congress to reset the situation with ivory back to where it was before this politically motivated ivory ban was put in motion. Knife Rights urges you to vote against HB 913, a bill that would unfairly penalize Oregon's ivory owners for others' illegal and immoral activities that will continue to threaten elephants, and which this proposed ivory ban does nothing to ameliorate. I would be happy to answer any questions you have.
We'll have questions after the panel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Roger Beyer here representing the NRA. The person who spoke in front of us may be a member of NRA, but he certainly does not speak for the organization. They have charged me to speak for the organization, and I, too, am a member of the organization. So I guess the organization does have many differing viewpoints. I won't dispute that point that he made. The testimony from NRA has been posted on OLIS. You all have it. I won't read it to you. I'll just like to point out some parts of it. This bill contains a limited exemption for the sale of weapons, which is interesting, but we don't feel it adequately addresses the concerns of law-abiding gun owners. But what makes it interesting is that the bill treats musical instruments much different than it does does firearms and knives. We think that's I guess interesting is the term. Why a different standard for musical instruments versus knives and guns? We don't understand that. We are opposed to both of these bans, but no one has been able to explain to us why it is treat musical instruments one way and guns and knife another. If it's good for musical instruments to be, for mammoths to be at the enactment of the bill and pre-1990 for elephant ivory, why not choose the same dates for guns and knives? That has never been pointed out to us. Another thing I'd like to point out on just on this, and we talked about the serial number on guns, ivory grips, ivory beads, inlays in guns can easily be changed and moved from one gun from another without documentation that is still pre-ivory. So just going by a serial number of gun, you can't say that's when that ivory was or wasn't made. So if you have pre-1976 ivory under this bill and a 1999 or a 2010 gun, is that an illegal gun if you have documentation for it? I don't know, but it's you can't go by the serial number of the gun to find that out. So that's another thing. There's not many people have that kind of documentation. This bill requires both documentation and a a volume measurement. We don't know how you measure the volume of a gun. If someone could explain that, that would be very helpful so we would know then how you know whether or not this gun is legal and this gun is not. By volume, is that volume by weight? Is that volume by size, by mass? What sort of volume are we talking about? Those are all problems with the bill. Another thing I'd like to point out that is not in the testimony, but this bill, federal law, allows people to today still go to Africa and legally harvest elephants. And then you can, with proper permitting and inspections, you can bring that ivory back into the U.S. So now with this bill, if it is enacted, the person who owns that ivory would then, when they pass on, that ivory would become worthless to their heirs, yet they would be likely to have a high inheritance tax on that ivory. Ivory is very expensive. And the federal inheritance tax model would recognize that as a value in the state, and that person, if they need to, would have no way to recoup the value of that ivory because they could not sell it. They couldn't even offer it for sale. Another piece of this bill, if you look at the language of the bill, and it says that if a person has is prima facie evidence that a person is trying to sell the ivory, or if they have it in a retail establishment where goods are offered for sale. So if there is ivory in a gun store, if there is an elephant mount in a gun store or elephant tusks in a gun store, and their items are offered for sale, that would be prima facie evidence of a crime. It doesn't say the ivory has to be offered for sale. It says goods have to be offered for sale. So it doesn't. So any place there's ivory displayed publicly and there are goods offered for sale, that would be prima facie evidence of that you have violated the statute. We don't think that's good public policy either. So, Mr. Chair, with that, I would happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
For the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. I'd like to point out that in my organization, people have a lot of different points of view as well. Not a single one of my members has expressed any support for this legislation. Senate Bill 913 is state-sanctioned theft. As has been pointed out, it will not save a single elephant or a single mammoth, which, of course, are extinct. The bill does not outlaw the sale of new ivory. It outlaws the sale of all ivory. The limited exceptions it provides make little sense. Trying to measure how much of a firearm, knife, or musical instrument is ivory by volume is absurd. When questioned how one measures the volume of a firearm, the sponsor of this bill responded, by volume. When I went to school, that would have not been considered an answer. When asked what kind of documentation would be acceptable to demonstrate a firearm was manufactured before 1976, the sponsor said it would be up to the police. As Mr. Beyer pointed out, if I have grips on a revolver that was built in 1935, I could easily move those grips to a different firearm, and then I suppose that would be illegal. The bill allows a person who commits the crime of selling his legally acquired property, kind of a trend around here, to be fined up to twice the fair market value of the ivory. What exactly is the fair market value of something that can't be sold on the fair market? The bill outlaws the sale of ivory but allows a person to give it away. If I have a pistol with ivory grips, I can sell the pistol and give away the grips. If I have a shotgun with ivory inlays, can I sell the shotgun and throw the inlays in for free? The bill does not prevent a person from simply selling the ivory in another state, so while the seller is greatly inconvenienced, no elephant is better off. We know this bill will have no effect on the illegal ivory trade, but the proponents wanted to make a statement. A statement of concern for elephants, rhinos, and extinct mammoths, but you do not save bald eagles by outlawing pterodactyl wings. And while it's certainly noble to want to save animals in Africa, no one proposing this legislation seems to care much about a person who will no longer be able to sell a family heirloom in time of financial need. No one seems to care that an antique dealer in Aurora who acquired something lawfully with the reasonable expectation that his investment might increase in value and he can make a small profit from it, now is being told his property has been rendered valueless. These people are not contributing to terrorism. They're not responsible for the behavior of radical Muslim extremists on the other side of the world. And this bill is not going to cost ISIS a dime, but it will effectively steal the property of the people you represent, and it should be defeated.
Chairman, members of the panel, my name is Alvin Richards. I am a custom knife maker. I reside in Salem, Oregon. I've been listening to the testimony here today. I find it quite interesting. Representative Krieger mentioned that there is sport hunting allowed still in Africa. There are several countries that allow sport hunting of elephant. Why do they allow sport hunting of elephant? Their elephant populations are increasing. That's interesting. Might want to look at that and see why. We have these wonderful pieces of art sitting over here. Why are they sitting over there? They're illegal. They're not allowed to be imported in the United States. They were confiscated. These items are already illegal to own. I deal in ancient ivory. I don't deal in it. I use it. I put it on the handles of my knives. I don't do it very often, but I like to have that option. My high-end customers like to see it. This bill will remove that opportunity for me to utilize mammoth ivory or mastodon ivory, who have been extinct for about 10,000 years. If this bill were enacted in nationwide, it would also affect many of the natives in Alaska who harvest this ancient ivory, not only mammoth, but walrus. It is fairly easy to distinguish between mammoth ivory. I didn't know how to until just prior to the Senate hearings. I got on the internet, looked it up. Skrager lines are pretty easy to identify. You just need to polish the end of the piece of ivory, look at it. If you want to take a Xerox copy, great. Use a protractor. It's not hard to use a protractor. I learned how to do it in second grade. I went through all of my ivory that I owned and verified it was mammoth. There was one piece that I was questionable about. I won't use that piece of ivory. That's one piece out of about 50 that I owned that may have possibly been a piece of elephant ivory. But the color tells me it wasn't. It had been buried in the ground probably for 15, 20,000 years. So there are different ways to tell other than just Skrager lines as far as what a piece of ivory, where it came from. Granted, Asian ivory, an Asian elephant is considered an endangered species. African ivory or African elephant is a threatened species at this time, not an endangered species anymore, because there are significant strides in increasing the populations in some countries, like I mentioned before. The exemptions that we have in this bill, 1976, I don't know where that number came from. 40 years is what I'm guessing. You figure that something at least 40 years old is going to be an antique. Hopefully I'm not considered an antique for very much longer, or not an antique anymore. Anyway, it's interesting that that number, because in 1976 or around that time frame, 1970s, is when the custom knife making market started to boom. That's when we all started to make knives. I didn't, I was only 16. And started using mammoth ivory. So everything made sense then, which is probably 90% of the pieces of the knives that were made with ivory on the handles is going to be illegal. It doesn't make sense to do that to people who purchased this in a legal manner, who bought this in, like was mentioned, with the hope of possibly selling it for at least what you paid for it, if not a slight increase. What is this going to do to me? If this bill passes, I won't be able to use ivory in the state of Oregon. I'll be able to go to a friend's house in the state of Washington, utilize the ivory up there, and sell it somewhere else. It's also going to prevent knife shows from coming to the state of Oregon. We've been trying to get a knife show on the West Coast because the ones in California are going away because of the prohibitive laws down there. There's a knife show that's starting in Portland this year, and I was hoping that it would continue. Well, if this law goes into effect, it won't, because the knife makers will not come. Neither will the collectors, because that's what they're looking for, is the mammoth ivory. It's not going to send it a single elephant. I, too, am wholly against poaching and the illegal harvesting of any animal. We need to look at this law. There are federal laws on the books. They can work. We can support the federal law. Those items right there are illegal. What more do we need? They did mention, some of the testimony did mention, that it's required that if you have a piece of ivory, it's supposed to have documentation. So does the person who using fresh, what I call fresh ivory, is from an elephant. They're required to have documentation, how much they had, how much it weighed. Every piece that they use off of it needs to be weighed. And a copy of their certificate should go along with the piece. So there are ways that you can tell if that piece of ivory is legal. I'd like to urge you to vote no on this bill. It does not make sense to me. Thank you.
Any questions? Council, can you talk for a second about the timelines there?
Yes, Chair Barker, members of the committee. I just wanted to briefly discuss some of the timelines that are actually relevant to federal and international law. So this is from a U.S. Fish and Wildlife document, and it's from September 2012. It was actually submitted to us by the NRA in the first chamber. So the African elephant was first listed in CITES Appendix 3 in 1976, and it was moved to Appendix 2 the following year. In 1978, the species was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act. In 1990, after nearly a decade during which African elephant populations dropped by almost 50%, the species was moved to Appendix 1 of CITES. It does go on, but that just I just want to reference those 1976 and 1990 dates so for everyone's knowledge.
Mr. Chair, if I forgot to mention something, which my colleague touched on. There's been a lot of discussion about the exceptions for musical instruments, for firearms, for knives. The exception for knives, first I should state I think the exceptions are useless. But for knives, they are especially useless because the vast majority of knives with elephant ivory have more than 20% of their volume, no matter how you measure it, unless it's pure weight, is the ivory handle. And how do you measure, and I go into detail in my submitted testimony, but how do you measure the volume of a hidden tang knife? You're going to take it to an X-ray, a 3D X-ray, to figure it out and go through all those computations? It's virtually impossible, and it'd certainly be very expensive. And as my colleague noted, the vast majority of mammoth and mastodon ivory used in these knives has been since the mid-70s, late-70s. So virtually all those will not be touched, and that is by far the vast majority of ivory used in knives. Thank you.
Thank you. Anybody have a question at all?
Thank you, panel.
With all testimony, we're not going to move the bill today, so is there any further business to come before the committee?
There was one more that was on that list.
Okay, I'm sorry. If anybody else to testify, please come up. Okay. Thank you for speaking up. I didn't.
Yeah. Well, this is my first hearing. My name is Ken Holmes. I'm from Albany. I stand before you in opposition to this bill, and it directly affects me in a pretty dramatic way. I started working in the art of.
Sit down.
Oh, oh.
Thank you.
Sorry.
Yeah, that's.
I started working with ivory back in 1977 while I was going to Oregon State. The artwork was shown to me as scrimshaw. I'd never heard of it, never seen any. But then I was shown some of the collection of John F. Kennedy and some of the other contemporary work of the time. And I had quite a bit of reservation about working with ivory, where it came from, the poaching problem that was there at the time. And at that time, a Dr. Gobi in Albany recommended I talked to a company out of Illinois. The man was a son of missionaries in South Africa and had started a business importing from the National Park Service in Botswana, Zimbabwe, and South Africa. All the proceeds from the sale of ivory to them went to the Park Service. Those parks are still outstanding in Botswana and Kruger in South Africa. Zimbabwe has been thrown into hyperinflation with a dictatorship, and who knows what's going to happen there. Most of the countries that have the worst ivory problems are countries where the government is corrupt and or disintegrated or having other major problems. I worked with this ivory until about 1988. The federal ban went into effect in 1989, and the company I was dealing with was quitting operations at that time because of the change in the law. I did quite a bit of work before that, sometimes for, like the piece I sent around, I worked for Norm Thompson's Outfitters. At that time, I got them to agree to 50% of their profit being donated to the African elephants' protection in Africa. I've also been very careful to make sure that that was the only ivory, elephant ivory I bought. And I bought probably 400 pieces at the end of that 1989 period. So I would have work to work on in the future. The pieces are an eighth of an inch thick. 4 pounds is about $4,000 back then. They're pieces that ivory is an amazing material. You can engrave on it almost to the point where you can't see it anymore. There's nothing that even comes close. At that time, I was supporting the National Park Services in Africa by buying the ivory, protecting the elephants. I still have quite a bit of that work that I haven't sold. For the last 15 years or so, I haven't sold anything. I've been making it, but I haven't sold any because I took the time to take care of my parents that were both very ill. Now I'm confronted with a situation where I will not be able to sell my work. My previous work will have no value. Work in the future will be extremely prohibited because no matter what I feel, I can't work for nothing. I've spent 40 years developing my talents and skills working in ivory. At the 1989 time, it took a couple years before I discovered mammoth ivory. That ivory I have bought has been big pieces. There's a piece in the photograph in one of the, on the article from the Register Guard back in 1988. Those are bark pieces. The mammoth ivory are large pieces of ivory. The outside is a bark that's maybe, it de-rings like a tree. So as the bark comes in layers, the pieces that I can afford to buy are the outside layers because you're buying it by the pound, $150 a pound or so, when it's available. It's no longer available. The Chinese market has bought everything. I've tried 4 years trying to find any mammoth ivory to buy. You can buy small shards and pieces, but nothing like what I wanted to work on. I have probably $5,000 worth that I bought large pieces bark. There's absolutely no way any of that could possibly be misinterpreted to be elephant ivory. If you cut into it, it stinks like the hell. It is horrible. If you smell my shop when I've been working cutting it, it's an amazingly putrid smell. The ivory shows up on the surface of the permafrost and survives for just a few months before it's totally saturated in water and minerals. So after a few months exposed to the oxygen in the air, it just disintegrates. It's like a piece of wood that's been sunk in a river. It's sitting there, saturated. If you bring it up and you dry it properly, you can use the wood. It's just like regular wood. It's heavier. And this old ivory is heavy. But it's fine. If you don't do anything with it, if you just let it sit there, it will disintegrate. The estimates I read last night on the internet from several sources said that the amount of mammoth ivory expected to be revealed in the permafrost in both Alaska and in Siberia, at the very minimum, is expected to be 15 million animals. At the high end, 45 million animals. Each one of these with a tusk that would be 40, 50 pounds at the tiniest. Most of the tusks were in the hundreds of pounds. This is an amazing resource that would just be taken away, that no one would ever be able to use. It's an amazing amount of money, and it's my livelihood, and it's something, a skill that I've taken a long time to develop. I've worked on preserving Oregon maritime history by specializing in the sail ships that were built along the Oregon coast. And I've had work in the Maritime Museum in Astoria. Once he verified that my work matched the pieces that he had shipbuilders' models of. The pieces I have of elephant ivory, if I had to not do anything with them, I would keep them as a pretty good collection for myself. It would be an expensive part. I expected to work on all these things when I retired in 2 years. But the mammoth ivory, especially, is something that I cannot possibly imagine just letting that resource just go away and lose an entire art form in the United States, one of our few indigenous art forms, at the same time. And so while I have always supported the preservation of elephants and the wildlife in Africa in all respects, this bill would make every one of my customers in the past, if they sold any of my pieces, guilty of a crime. If I just kept the pieces I have right now that are unfinished and somebody reported me, it would be the same as somebody with a bag of pot. If it's an ounce of pot, it might be a misdemeanor. If you have it divided up into eighths, it's probably going to be an arrestable thing. If I kept the ivory and did nothing with what I have now, it could be construed that I had ivory for sale, whether it was or not. And so for these things alone, I'm very wary of this bill, and I urge you to consider my testimony.
Thank you. I'd like to ask you a question.
Yes.
You know the
I'm
answer.
Open
I
to,
don't. I'm asking because I don't know. I remember seeing a whale wash up in Washington a few years ago. And
right.
Somebody was trying to take the teeth for scrimshaw, and then I don't remember which law enforcement said you can't do that.
1972 Endangered Species Act says no whale. No marine mammal product will be transferred across state lines for purposes of resale.
If one washed up in the Oregon Beach, could you take a tooth and work?
If I just found the tooth, I probably would be able to. I could only sell it within the state of Oregon. I still couldn't take it without having it verified by the federal people that it was of an age. In Alaska, some of the marine mammal, if it's a washer, something that's just washed up on the beach and they can tell it's been washed because it has a certain patina to it, you can get a permit. And you can do whatever you want to with it, walrus tusk, whale's tooth, whatever. But pieces that you just picked up on your own, you wouldn't be able to.
Pulled out of a whale.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Holm? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Well, thank you for your consideration.
Close the public hearing on Senate Bill 913. And stand adjourned. Thank you. And stand adjourned. Thank you on Senate Bill 913.